Okay. Thank you for having me. We're going to talk a little bit about Fort Tryon Jewish Center. So if you could please tell me your name and maybe a little bit about yourself.
My name is Jack Murad, and I was born and raised in Washington Heights. I lived there for most of my life. I moved to Riverdale about 10 years ago, but that means that about 60 years was spent in the area of Fort Tryon Jewish Center. As a profession, I was a teacher and administrator, assistant principal and administrator in the New York City public school system, and I retired in 2006, but presently work 3 days a week with the Department of Education, working with three principals in three schools in the South Bronx.
Okay. So, Mr. Murad, when did you first get involved with Fort Tryon Jewish Center?
Okay, I had a young son during the 80s. We were originally members of the Reform Synagogue across the street. And as he was growing up, he had some trouble. He was active and wanted roles, and there were very few children over there at the Hebrew Tabernacle. And my wife wanted him, you know, more involved. And we were becoming more and more observant. And so we eventually moved over to the Fort Tryon Jewish Center. At the time, just about this time, there was a young rabbi named David Nesanoff who knew how to deal with kids, and my son was very, very comfortable. And 2 or 3 years down the road, he was to be bar mitzvahed, so it was important to hook him up with somebody like that. Unfortunately, David Nesanoff was a young man with new ideas, and we had a board that was older and wanted status quo, and eventually fired him. The next rabbi, Rabbi Pinchas Pearl, during his inauguration, we came over to the Fort Tryon Jewish Center, which is approximately 1987, and we joined the synagogue.
Okay, so you started in about 1987.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so were there a lot of children there?
Not really.
Mm-hmm.
Not really, but there were some.
Mm-hmm.
He did have, they were looking for people to take active roles, and I did do that. And he was able to do some of the things to help me. So he became more comfortable. The Rabbi Pearl was a nice man to my son, and the cousin, Sidney Oaks, who had been there since the 50s, was also very likable person. And my son got along with both of them. So it was a good fit. And it worked into our growing religious observance.
Okay, great. So how long have you been a member then?
I would say I'm a member since, 1987.
Okay.
So
why, were you born in Washington Heights?
Yes, I came from a Sephardic family. Parents are from Baghdad, Iraq. They located on 158th Street, which at that time was the lower part of Washington Heights. And we lived there I wasn't born then, but they lived there from 1937 to 37 to 67,
mm-hmm.
and then moved up to the area of the synagogue, Upper Washington Heights near Fort Tryon Park, in 1967, and I remained there until 2004.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. So can you describe a little bit more about what Fort Tryon Jewish Center was like then?
Well, It was still an important Jewish institution in Washington Heights. The heyday of Fort Tryon Jewish Center was more in the 60s and the 70s. So although attendance still kept up even in 80s to 75 to 100 people on Shabbat, I would think that's the way to really gear the growth or lack of it of the synagogue. Mm-hmm. On Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, when I joined, there was still enough people, 420 upstairs, and there was still 150 who needed an extra service downstairs so that everybody could be accommodated. Mm. So in the late 80s, we still had two services. Mm-hmm. But that slowly changed by Rabbi Pearl stayed until about 92. Members began moving. Their children did not stay in Washington Heights. And so I would say that from the time that I joined to the time that the building closed, the attendance was dwindling to practically, a sad state of affairs. Mm. But during the time, it was still the time that when I was there. I mean, just to give you an idea, I joined in 87, mm-hmm. and in 88, I'm already on the board. Mm-hmm. That means, right away, they're looking, anybody there who's showing an interest in the synagogue, that were grabbed to be members of the board. By 1991, I was asked to be chairperson of the board, and I served there until 95. And in 1995, they were looking for a new leader, and I became president of the shul in 1995, and I remained president until 2011. Unheard of in a vibrant or a growing or a synagogue, but because the synagogue membership was dwindling. Because the officers were older, there wasn't anybody willing to step up to take over. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, prior to 10 years before I came, there was a president. You could see a long list of presidents, and they served sometimes 2 years, sometimes even 1 year, mm-hmm. But that changed a lot. My predecessor was there for quite a long time also. Maybe I would say 10 years. Again, it was a combination of her type of leadership and the fact that nobody wanted to step up. Mm-hmm. So that's the way it is. So here we are in 2016. The membership, we were down to a handful. We were 2 weeks from closing. In 2007, mm-hmm. but because we had a great member lawyer by the name of Peter Bergman, he was able to set up a deal that we sold our air rights so that a project could come in, build an apartment building, and we would the air rights would be enough to sustain us. Mm-hmm. So in 2007, that occurred. That was just within 2 weeks, maybe 10 days before we would have had to close the doors because there wasn't enough money to pay the last persons to be paid, and that would be the caretaker of the building and the cantor, the chazan. Mm-hmm. So luckily, fortunately, the money dropped in. Within a certain amount of time, months, we had to close the doors so that we could have renovation. The shul was gutted, and then the developer could not pay his bills. He couldn't get any more money from the bank, and so since 2007, the building has remained basically gutted. Mm. Yeah, waiting for an elevator, a new boiler, and a new electrical system, among a number of things, and a complete renovation of the social hall and the sanctuary. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so what? So as time went on, from the time that I took it, there were many good moments. Being in a leadership capacity gave me the opportunity to do many of the things that that I think, like whatever God intended me to do. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the way it is when you're working as a teacher in the South Bronx for 20 years. Mm-hmm. You're really no more. You're not about giving imparting knowledge, although that you have to do. But you're dealing with children who have severe needs. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that was just as important to me as getting them to move up from one grade level to another grade level. Mm-hmm. And so the same thing came with the synagogue. With the synagogue gave me the opportunity to fulfill needs that I had. And it's not about keeping the synagogue open, but it was about providing minions for people who lost. I mean, it's incredible number of people who had terrible, terrible losses during anybody in leadership in the synagogue can know what it's like. It's like every month there's something. Mm-hmm. It might be good, it might be bad. And so those are the greatest satisfaction that I had as president or as a member, that I could have something to do with providing a bat mitzvah for somebody who's 37 years old and never got one in their lives, converted and done, or providing an opportunity for boys and their fathers and mothers who didn't have a synagogue they belonged to, who could now find a place that said, "Yo, you don't have to be a member here for you to have a bar mitzvah here or a bat mitzvah here." Mm-hmm. And so, so my greatest feelings or satisfaction is the ability to have been able to, you know, fulfill mitzvahs that are required of us in Torah. So, and to be able to be supportive of some very, very, very good rabbis, and the cantor who was with us for so much, he was willing to sacrifice so much to remain as the cantor until some illness said, "Okay, I can't do this anymore." Mm-hmm. So that's the reason. Now, today, what is my what the people in synagogue? We have 132 members, mm-hmm. right?
Currently,
currently, mm-hmm. 100 okay. member units. Mm-hmm. That could be 200 people. Mm-hmm. There are 100 people coming to Shabbos, to services on Shabbat. There are kids all over the place. At least anywhere from 60 to 75 children coming to shul on a given Shabbat. So. If anybody can remember, very few of them know what that building was or looked like. And what do I get credit for hanging in all those years until the time we could move forward and get to where we are today? Mm-hmm. I guess that would have been true. I mean, you know what it's like, and there are other people like me who are practically, you know, one person leaders in a shul just to keep it going. Mm-hmm. There are a couple like that. Mm-hmm. And they do it, and then maybe one day, if they're strong enough to give it up to other people, it wasn't easy, and it's still not easy for some of the people the few people who are left, who had any kind of leadership with the old shul to give it up and say, okay, I don't, some, and they don't, you know, very oftentimes they don't even ask, you know, of it. You get some respect, but sometimes you don't get asked anymore about what we should do and what we should. So I'm presently a member of the executive board, which is a really very nice thing, and a member of the board itself. In a couple of years, maybe my term will expire, and then that part of it will be over. But they didn't have to invite me to the executive. That is just a committee that really thinks about the hard decisions that have to be made, and then takes it to the board. And usually, the former president is allowed on it. But the present president said, okay, I want the former president, and he asked me to be on it. So it was a very, very nice gesture on his part. Mm-hmm. Also, there's a lot of responsibility on my part to attend those meetings and to be active and supportive of the things that they're doing, which they're doing really fine things.
Can you talk a little bit about those things?
About what they're doing?
Yeah.
Well, you have these 60 plus children, 75 children. You can't just say let them come and go all over the place. Mm-hmm. So, under the leadership of Rabbi Guy Austrian, we hired one of our own members as a youth director, Lainey Solomon, and together they, along with a committee, Youth and Family, have put together a real educational program. Very, very difficult. Education of newborns to say 12 of high school.
Mm.
Okay, we have those, and you can't just give the same thing or just say, okay, go in the room and somebody do it. So they came up with goals with the Youth and Family Committee. They came up with goals. They're going to share these goals. And from what I'm hearing from all of everybody concerned, that it's really working. So that's been it. In fundraising, they've been able to raise a significant, had a nice affair, and they raised $40,000 to help offset the deficits that are going to occur, because the 132 member units are made up of many, many young students.
Mm.
They're not going to be able to put a lot of money into membership. And so there's a new formula for how people will renew their membership. It's not just one fee. They ask those of you can afford more based on what you give during the year, and membership contributions have gone up. And then they have a social action, social justice committee that's worked for 9 months now, and are headed in a direction to look for agencies who are trying to working on the issue of trying to get housing for lower income and displaced people.
Mm-hmm.
And so although we are not doing anything yet, but we've identified organizations that are good at that. And in Inwood, there's going to be a new buildings going up. The challenge will be to find out how people who are lower income people can get He had apartments in those buildings. Mm-hmm. I mean, just today's paper showed that these people who have a Section 8, which was programmed to try to get a mixture in a building, so their landlord puts away these Section 8 apartments, and so you got a nice mixture in these buildings, mm-hmm. but they're taking away these apartments are being gentrified, they're being lost, and so as the city becomes richer and richer, many people are being displaced. So then there's unscrupulous landlords that I personally can attest to. They'll do anything to get people out of their apartments. So that will be one issue that we'll be tackling in the next 12 months, along with trying to make our own congregation more thoughtful about people with disabilities and mm-hmm. And people in the congregation. Transgender is a very, very important issue, and we're tackling that by having workshops and explaining, because I need explanation, exactly what's going on there, and then we have a handicapped person who can't get up, and we're trying to build a permanent ramp for that person and maybe others. See, just learn right now. I mean, you could say, how do you know if you're providing people with special needs? But we don't have any deaf people in our shul. Well, if you don't have anything to help them, how would you know? How would they know to become? So, we're doing more than that, and so. These are just some of the issues they're thinking about, how to get programming, adult programming for people. There's so many wonderful things going on, but the best part, and it's something that I saw right away, is that people step up. You hardly have to. I've never seen such a group of people. In the old days, people were bickering, people didn't like each other, they were cliquish. But here, if something has to be done, whether it's stacking chairs, picking up food, cleaning floors, there are people willing to do that. Not everybody, but enough people to make it happen, because it's all lay-led. The only people that are paid is the rabbi and... there are two jobs. One is for a person who cooks or makes sure that the kiddush is provided each week. Mm-hmm. And the reason we have him is because kiddush became a tremendous vocal point of the shul, and still is. That it's not just some kiddush that is a standard thing. Somebody makes cholent and says here. But the person likes to cook and provides a greater variety of foods. Mm-hmm. So everybody knows that here at Fortran you could come and you'll see some things you don't usually get. And people, younger people, want different things, that some of us just would be happy to have our kugel and our thing. But that's that. And the third employee is the youth and family director, the one who's doing such a splendid job providing goals for the lay-led instructors of the classes. And she sits with them and works with them. So this way, and it's just very, very wonderful people. Not 100%, but a lot more than I've ever experienced.
So you talked about, or you mentioned how maybe when you first came there, things weren't as maybe socially active and concerned with the children and new issues that are in. So what? How did the congregation change, or and what do you think brought that on? And was that a purpose? Or was that intentional? Or did that just kind of evolve with the membership?
Okay. Probably the biggest. There are two main reasons why the the synagogue began to prosper. The first of which that I spoke about years and years during the lean years.
Like around the late 80s, you said.
Getting to be around 1992.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
All right? Rabbi Pearl, he's been there for 5 years. Mm-hmm. He's ambitious. He sees the what's going on, and he says, I'm leaving. Mm-hmm. Okay? I'm gonna get another job for the weekends, but I'm gonna be something else, and I'm gonna make more money. So he sees the writing on the wall. Now we're going from there. We're going as not full time rabbis. So during those years, pushes. We see everything is down. The real estate is down. You could buy an apartment in 730 Fort Washington Avenue for, if you were living in that apartment, you could buy it for $30,000. That same apartment today is $800,000. Mm. Okay? But in that time, things were dead. Mm-hmm. And we kept thinking, eventually it's going to happen, that more and more people are going to find that the rent's down in the east side, the upper east side, and the upper west side are going to be tremendous, and they're going to move. We joined, all the synagogues in Washington Heights joined together and met many, many times to what could we do to encourage young Jewish people, families, to come to him. We went as far as Phoenix, Arizona, sending letters saying, here, we have a congregation. We'll provide you with apartments. We'll do everything we can. We participated in Shabbat, the Shabbat thing that's done worldwide once a year. Anything to get people to involve. Well, it didn't happen in 1992 or 93, but it began to happen in the 2000s. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, a few people showed up. We were still in our building. All right, they weren't jumping to go into a congregation when they went down there. We have 420 seats, and 20 of them or 30 of them are occupied. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we gave them the full service with a real chazan, and everything was the way it was when there were 200 people in the auditorium, and we never let up. There were no cheating, no shortcuts. So, but suddenly they began to go upstairs, and they asked me, well, "Could we? We're young families. We have young children. We want to have a Shabbat experience for them." So we gave them we had a nursery up on the second floor. See, the synagogue in the 60s, 70s, my own son went to that nursery. Mm-hmm. The synagogue was getting paid a lot of money mm-hmm. to run a nursery. Mm-hmm. But the Y came. And that people wanted to start going to the Y. We were suddenly taking on people with problems, kids that are getting paid. We were getting paid from grants, money for to educate children with special needs, and so anyway, as this young families took on the second floor, they became more interested in what was going down below. And some people who were interested in the shul or in this type of, almost this type of congregation, began coming. And the second thing was a push to move from traditional Orthodox, conservadox, where, yes, there was mixed seating, but women did not have any role, or very little role. We did as much as we possibly could, but that's about it. The president could have been a woman, but she rarely talked from there. So we went and took a vote. We lost a lot of members that way, but we took a vote to become egalitarian. And once that happened, the younger people began to join the regular congregation, and little by little, under the leadership of the rabbi, and then the next rabbi, we were able to. So it's the push of young people who keep moving from lower Upper West Side and the Upper East Side, coming to us because they're looking for affordable rents. In the meantime, they're very often they're displacing some of the people who have been here for years and years and years. That's the downside. So that, along with the to go traditional egalitarian. And we have a lot of support from the traditional egalitarian yeshiva downtown called Mechon Hadar. One of the three gentlemen that run that, the rabbis that run that program, is a member of us, and is there every single Shabbos. And those two things began to. With this influx of newer people, these are professional people, these are young people, okay? All of a sudden, I became very old compared to these people. And and still today, the 40 is, 40, 41 is about the highest, and it drops down to 20. 23. Mm-hmm. So and so you have professionals, lawyers, doctors, accountants, real estate lawyers, all kinds of people, and I told you they're just willing to put this forward, like they feel like they have a ownership in this place, mm-hmm. and that it's important for their children, even though we're not in a building, which is a tremendous drawback. So those are the two things. Going egalitarian, that cost us some very wonderful people, because, and mostly, believe it or not, women. The women did not like the idea of women having a part. And they left, and but from there, people started to join under the leadership of the two rabbis. They went out. They believed in this, and they brought people in little by little. Some come, some go, some come, and this is the way it goes. But still, you're going. We were at most, I remember when I left presidency, maybe 91. Now we're up to 132. Mm-hmm. And still people moving in. More people moving in than are moving out. But we do lose. We lose some great people. But that's the way it goes. You have to live with that. Having to see really wonderful people leaving. But they have to do what, you know, it's a lot of times it's jobs. The doctor who wants to do work on AIDS in Israel, and another doctor who really got himself a good job in Pittsburgh, the university, and stuff like that. Or somebody would say, I have a child now, and I need some help with my mother-in-law to help with the child. And so they leave. And these are really terrific people. But along comes, little by little, not terrific people. And I love the kids from, you know, the Yeshiva Hadar, who are, you know, They're just really very, very nice people that are willing to help as much as they can. So it's really been nice. You know, what? How do you stay young? You know, being in a school is really a nice way to be, to stay young, being in a synagogue and interacting with the younger people is a great way, you know, to feel wanted and very much loved by younger people is a great feeling. Yeah, along with the love you receive from your family.
So you talked about being a little bit uncomfortable with the congregation being itinerant at this point.
Yeah.
So could you talk a little bit more to that, and then also maybe about how you think the newer members feel about it?
Very simple. Yeah, I mean, you want to have classes, but I don't want to keep. This is the one thing. I live here, and the congregation's there. This is personal. I mean, it's just really hard for me to go to everything. Now, if I was living there, I felt well, I would go to a lot of these things that I can't go anymore. But the important thing is that there's no central location for to it. A lot of times you announce in shul that something important is going to happen, but we don't even know where it's going to happen because it's last minute. So you need a place, you need a classroom, you need a place to have and call home. It's really nice when you have your own shul and all your materials are at where you know they are, not living with a congregation that has to move your stuff around. I'm not saying they do a bad job, but they do move it around and things get lost because they have a different mindset about their shul. You know, we're being currently housed in the Hebrew Tabernacle, who does not have the kind of membership they would have to sustain the synagogue. So they have to rent space to keep a lot. So very often we're displaced by organizations that have to utilize the space when we're not utilizing it. We have a hard time. You always have a hard time when you're renting space from somebody else. And I'm very positive towards the Hebrew Tabernacle. Others that have to deal with them every day are not happy. So Jewish observance is not only about Saturday. We can handle Saturday in most places, but we have holidays, and holidays can come on Sunday, which is a church day, and it can come on Thursday and Friday. It can come anywhere, and those things are important. Pesach is 4 days, and Sukkot and Simchas Torah and Shemini Atzeres is 4 days, and Purim is 1 or maybe 2 days, and so forth, and Shavuot is 2 days, and there are other things, and not to mention the minor fast days and Tisha B'Av and all this, and all of these are big issues. Where to do it? We celebrate the birthday of Israel this past week. But where can we do this? Mm-hmm. The Hebrew Tabernacle is closed on Thursday. So we have to go to somebody's home. It's good in a way. Some people like it. I prefer... what is the guy, that's Rabbi Kampfer... What is he supposed to do? He's gonna have a talit, the shawl. He's gonna have books for everybody. He's gonna have. Does he have enough chairs? Mm-hmm. Maybe 50 people show up. Maybe only 20 show up. What do you do? Half the people standing. Oh, they don't mind. Okay, so you don't have the opportunity to provide any kiddush for people, whatever. People sometimes don't have any place to go. A lot of people work. Most of them do work. but some don't. And if you were in your own building, you'd have a place just to sit and chat over some bagels and something that's very inexpensive. So we have a lot of things that we want to do, but we don't have a place to do it. And if we're in Hebrew Tabernacle, and Saturday we can have our yontif, our holiday, but Sunday is the second day, we got to go to the church. So we go to the church, and the church is great, and it's a wonderful space, and everybody's good. But who's carrying all the books? Mm-hmm. How do you know how many people are going to show up? Mm-hmm. 50, 75, 25, who knows? They might be going to the parents' house, some other place. We don't know. Mm-hmm. And so what do? You have to, you take 50 prayer books. Then you take the Sefer Torah, two of them, heavy. Don't want anything to happen to them, and the whole bunch of stuff that you need in order to have a proper service, and then you got to make sure it gets back. And sure, guess what? Sometimes things get lost. You can't have what you want. This guy likes to read out of this prayer book. All of a sudden, he doesn't have that anymore, because he can't bring everything. So somebody's deciding what you should bring and what you shouldn't bring. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it goes. That's what we have to deal with. It's the only available space right now is in the Washington Heights Collegiate Church, who is not ready for accommodating us and any other day but for Saturday. Saturday is a slow day for them, but Sunday and Thursday, and who knows what the calendar says for this year. So we can sometimes, like yesterday we had our annual membership meeting in their hall, and we pay a fee, and it's good. But it doesn't always work that way. So that's the drawback. I find it a major drawback. If I knew the central location for anything and knew that we could stay there or not stay there, past the time, you go to shul and everybody could be happy. The service could go. There's no such thing as a service is exactly a certain time. It is not that way. Sometimes there's lots of stuff that has to be said in the prayers that are not normal. And you get out, say it extends. We have a deadline. 1 o'clock, you got to get out of there. Mm. So by 12:45, we're yelling at people. Now, they may not have just started. People who go to Kiddush, they sit for hours. Mm. And they could stay there for almost 2 hours. But you have to get out. If you go, I don't know how serious it is, but say you go 5 minutes over. Well, the Hebrew Tabernacle says I had to pay my man an extra hour, and all of a sudden you have to now fork over $75 more because of it. So that those are the restraints. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I'm happy that we're able to have a deal with a Jewish institution, and the church has been unbelievably great. Mother Cabrini was great, and Washington Heights Collegiate has been great, but they're going to be conflicts.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit more about the Washington Heights community and how it's changed over time?
So I was living there since 1967. There was a lot of nice things there at the time. There was a delicatessen, there was a bakery, there were banks, there were a great supermarket, and then we had two banks. And
you said this was about, what street was that? You said
187.
187.
Yeah, the original shul was was underneath a bakery. Mm. So there were a whole lot of things when I first moved in, and it was very, very crowded with people, young people, all kinds of people. It was really very, very nice and very different from where I was living on 158th Street. It became very crowded over there, and new immigrants were moving in, what used to be two or three people in an apartment, there were four or five people, and that brought in a lot of problems. And so we moved up, and for a while, it was, you know, wonderful. You saw people, a lot of people going to the park, and there were a lot of things to do in the area. But then suddenly, people started to grow older, and you know, I was in the building. It was 1975. I went to building. There were no children in the building, not one. Mm. This was all older people that wanted to retire to Florida. In fact, I had to pay with a little more, whatever money I had, only to get that apartment. I had to pay out of $1,000 to a guy who needed no money, who didn't need any money. Mm. But he said, I'm not leaving until I get something for stuff that I couldn't use. Mm. You know, his carpet, his furniture, his fun. Well, that's the way it was. And there were no children. Then my son was the first child in a long time to be in the building. And then there another lived on 7th floor, another on 6th floor. And there suddenly there were some children in the building. But for a long time, it was mostly older people. As I talked about that it became, you know, there was nobody on the streets during the 80s. It was really serious. Is that it was a high crime area. It was not where I lived, but further down around 181st Street and 80th, 79th, 70th, you know, where the convergence of New Jersey, Connecticut, Yonkers, up lower Manhattan, they all came and they were buying and selling drugs quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of crime. I had a car, a brand new car in 1985 that got broken into several times. Mm. I had cars that were kicked on the sidewalk by people hitting it, or broken windows busted, tires stolen. This was happening quite a bit. And they were happening even with people in the neighborhood. People got away with stuff like that in those days. You would catch the guy, and somehow he'd be 24 hours later, he'd be back in home, ready to do the same thing. And then it started to clean up, I think, under Giuliani. Things got a little bit better. And that's when we were trying to sell Washington Heights. So what they do, they invented a name. They had some beautiful buildings over by Cabrini, right? And they invented the name Hudson Heights. Mm-hmm. And they were trying to sell that real estate. And so eventually the neighborhood started to go from nothing on the streets at night to now you walk at 10:30 at night, and the train comes, A train comes in, and 20, 30 people walking outside. Mm-hmm. Very unheard. Now, what do you have here? 187th Street, you have bars. You have bars and restaurants all over the place. Mm-hmm. That wasn't the way it was. This was a bodega. It was an old Irish bar that went out of business. A liquor store. Things changed quite a bit. Mm-hmm. It's geared for young professionals. And it's great to see the chairs outside and people having fun and enjoying themselves here and even up in Riverdale. Some of the places are in lower Riverdale you see packed on Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night. You see those bars, sports bars, are packed with younger professional people. So you see people out in the street. I think it's safer. The park is safer.
Mm-hmm.
Where at one time, you know, there were just terrible things going on.
Mm-hmm.
The park was filthy. People just threw garbage. And I was try to be part of the team that helped to clean it up all the time. But now, it's you know, we had a capital project over at Fort Tryon Park during the 90s. Stanley Michaels, the councilman, was very, very important in getting that. And now the park is really so well taken care of. The cafe that was there once, but not very important, now is a place where you see weddings, you see activity.
Mm-hmm.
At least till 10, 11, sometimes 12 o'clock at night, keeping the park safer. They have now no parking signs, which make it illegal to park after 12. Because many people used to come, drugs, whatever it was, they could stay there all the time. So it became safer. More professionals came in, and there've been a lot of improvements. A lot of improvements over by Yeshiva University, and gentrification brought some Wadsworth and Broadway, East of Broadway, wasn't always very nice, but now I think it's much safer. 181st Street is like, it's like crazy with all the vendors. I don't know if you know it.
Yeah. Yeah, I attend Yeshiva University. So,
oh, okay.
So yeah, I'm there a lot. Yeah, there's always bustling and shopping.
Yeah,
and
bustling.
Stuff.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
It's hard to even walk through. I mean, a person could get very dizzy walking and seeing all the people. I'm used to it, but it's almost like 34th Street
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
with all the people.
Right.
Yeah, so those are the changes, amazing changes over the years, in terms of what the neighborhood looked like. I wish I could remember, some of the older places, but it's just real great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, here all the way up 181st Street completely. Nobody ever went. It went further than a few stores west of 181st and Fort Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly, I mean, nothing, there was nothing. And now you have so many different establishments to Cabrini.
Mm-hmm.
So, important,
One. Just have a couple more questions.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so you talked extensively about the programs available for children. So I was curious also, are there other programs for adults or even older adults?
We're trying. Like I said, there are classes that are offered for adults in Jewish education. Some like basic Hebrew. Others helping. Helping people who want to convert, helping those who know very little and want to become more observant, classes to guide you through the morning service on the Sabbath. But the rabbi complains that there are not enough people signing up for those classes. And although we have advertised taken surveys of what people want, they haven't gone off. Maybe it's because we don't have a central location or it's not worked out too well.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as older adults, there's very little. The local synagogue here is doing something.
Mm-hmm.
They got a grant to what they call baby boomers,
Mm-hmm.
And there, they had an event with people who signed up. It was very, very successful. I don't know if there are that many of these people in our in Fort Tryon Jewish Center. Mm. This is a problem. That's why we're a lot more friendly than the group here. It's a nice group, a nice synagogue, nice rabbi and cousin, but a lot of people, a lot of older people there with us. Oh. Yeah, in Fort Tryon Jewish Center. Maybe seven people over the age of 42 who come to services.
Okay.
And they're well taken care of. There's two of them over 92 women, and they're adored by the younger people, or they're cared for.
Mm-hmm.
One is brought in wheelchair every single, this is what I'm talking about, how nice. There's a turn, people take turns bringing this lady to shul. She will not be able to go to shul because her home attendant won't take her.
Mm-hmm.
So they bring her and take her back every week. And it is so important to her to be able to get out and to be able to just sit there and see the people that come. So, and there's another lady who can get in with a walker. She's got a back problem. And she's in her 90s. They're both close to 95.
Mm-hmm.
And they're well attended when they come. We have a 94-year-old man, and he participates in services. He leads services at the beginning. But he says his parent is getting harder for him, and he's about ready to join his children in Florida permanently. There's another man, 90, in his 80s, late 80s, who is, I just lost his wife, but he's determined to hang on. And that's what I'm doing. And then there's, I'm 72. There's another one, 69 and 68. That's basically, and then there are around some 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, maybe in the Karen, a few others.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not talking about a whole lot now.
Mm-hmm.
10 yeah. people, and yeah. some of them would not be able to attend services other than Shabbat.
Mm-hmm.
But these people have complained that there's nothing for us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for me, like I have so many things to do there
mm-hmm.
that I'm not complaining.
Mm-hmm.
But, and same with the two or three or four that I know of. We're participating in other things, so
mm-hmm.
we don't need specifically anything, but there are others who have nothing
mm-hmm.
and not doing more. So they either get involved with one of the committees or, you know, there's just nothing out there. With this over here, they had this Saturday night. And all these baby boomers came, and they all brought pictures of themselves when they were in their teenagers.
Okay.
Threw the pictures down,
mm-hmm.
and then you come in and you're supposed to draw one from there.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're supposed to go all around and try to find who that person is.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
And then when you find out, you take a pen and you put their name on and you write something on the picture.
Mm-hmm.
And they had some game shows. They did some like game shows from the 50s or 60s, and where these the couples were participating in. So it was kind of and some dancing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, people of the generation that generation was gone, but used to be, where did you get gender? maybe you had a TV, but you know, you used to go to dances.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That dancing was really, really very important part of your social activities.
Mm-hmm.
And so many people, like in the Y, you see it. 80 people in their 80s and they love to dance.
Yes.
And it's incredible. It's incredible to be able to dance, and it's not really hard to dance.
Mm-mm.
If you know basics, right?
Right.
And it's a lot of fun and a lot of good exercise.
Mm-hmm.
So they had that in there. And so it would be nice. It would be nice if they had some things like that. So they don't.
Well, I just have one more question, and then I'll leave it.
Okay.
What would you like to see at Fort Trojan?
Well, now that you brought it up, it would be really nice that these people who are in their 50s, 60s have something for them, for themselves. And my biggest wish is to have a building.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very complicated, and it will involve... It'll be more expensive to operate,
mm-hmm.
but I would like to see it. All my dreams have been realized. I wanted to have a synagogue with young people. I wanted to have a service that was where people participated, not somebody just singing and we're listening. But what we have now is lay-led, beautiful, beautiful melodies that go along with the prayers. We have a very, very observant people, and there is no cheating in terms of the service itself. And I'm so happy. It is at an extremely high level, and everybody goes out of their way to ensure. You know, I'm a member of the ritual committee, and the ritual committee has policies that ensure that we try to do everything that is ritually correct under the guidance of with the direction of the rabbi. So that's what I wanted. I wanted to get the synagogue service was a very, very important part of enjoyment for myself and meaning for myself, and that has been realized. The day we went became egalitarian, and the day that young people came into the shul and brought all their wealth of experiences and when they were growing up in camp. So I could say for myself, I came from parents who were from very, very Orthodox families in Iraq, both mother and father. And when they came here, they struggled to make a living. And so they gave, and they were Sephardic, who lived in a very, very Ashkenazic community of German refugees. And so there was no place for them to feel comfortable. So my father davened at home, and there really wasn't much of a religious experience for myself. I got a chance in the local synagogue to go on high holidays when there were children's services, and nobody asked for a ticket. And so basically I used to sneak into the synagogue, and I enjoyed it a great deal, but I had no, all my friends complained bitterly about having bar mitzvahs and having to go to Hebrew school, and I didn't have any of that, and I didn't have any bar mitzvah, except one day my father wrapped tefillin around me and made me wear an ugly suit, and said, invited a few friends, and it became like a birthday party, and that was how I was bar mitzvahed. And it wasn't until married years, having my own child, and realizing that he needs a Jewish experience, and it's going to help me. I'm going to find a community that's going to help me to raise him. And so, together with my wife and son, we joined the synagogue, and little by little we acquired knowledge of the more observant that we became, the more life became a little bit easier.
Mm-hmm.
And I really, at this point, I can't. I would be to open up a can of worms if I told you at that time, after having given birth, my late wife took sick, and we struggled for the next 18 years until she passed away from liver and kidney illness. But during that time, we became Shomer Shabbos observant, fewer bad things happened to us, like her having to go to the hospital for very, very serious things. It didn't end very well, but at least we had more peace.
Mm-hmm.
And so, she passed away, and my son went to Israel. He now, later, got married and has 5 children.
Uh-huh.
And so it all works out. It all works out for the best. She did her best to raise him. So what I'm saying is he's raising them in the tradition, in the Orthodox tradition, most of his schooling was in a religious school, and he did experience public school too, and now he's headed in direction. His children are going to head in the right direction, the direction that my parents once had from their parents.
Mm-hmm.
So it works out, and I'm able to sustain my observance over all these all the years since we accepted Shabbat around 1989, having met Orthodox people and seeing how they lived, and Fortran has been enough to support my observance. And I'm very happy. I'm very happy that I'm, I get all the credit for staying in there. You know, that was one of my strong points. Everybody comes and goes. My head hurts from people mm-hmm. coming and going. It's like the same in my school. I've been in the same building. I still work in the same building that I worked in December of 1971.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So there are not many people who could say that.
Mm-hmm.
So the same with Fortran. I made it a point, even though I live in Riverdale, it was a compromise for my wife Ella to find a place that we both can feel comfortable in, and this was it. So, but I promised myself that I'll do everything I can to maintain my presence in Fortran, and hope that that I have a meaningful influence in the. It was really important. The former president. One thing she did: the minute she wasn't president, she never come to shul again.
Mm.
And I knew, and I see all others where their participation dwindles completely. Like, oh yeah, so that's the most important thing. If I'm president, then I'll come to shul every day, or no. So I had to show this congregation and myself that I'm ready to do everything I can, even though I'm not president, and I'm not an officer, and so that's the way I feel. I think it's very meaningful. My father showed me that basically. He never talked, he never said anything, he just acted.
Mm-hmm.
He just was that person. And I'd say the same for my mother. Exactly, two nice people.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Mr. Murad. Okay.
Thank you.
Really appreciate that. And do you have any final thoughts, or we're okay?
No, just my final thought is thank you for having the opportunity to say these things. It wasn't exactly what I thought, but I think that I feel satisfied in what I've said during this conversation.
Okay.
I hope it will be meaningful.
Yes, I'm sure it'll be wonderful. Thank you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.